Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Here with my two compadres, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office, now a manager on our SIU team, and Matt Kachansky, retired OIG senior leader, the retired Northeast UPIC, and our payment integrity director. And Jason is still on his, it's like he's on maternity leave or something. I don't even know anymore. He's just out and about driving his big bus around the country, his RV.
Like John Madden. Yeah, he's got the Madden.
Yeah, he's just driving. Yeah, Madden refuses to fly anywhere. Just kind of drives everywhere. So, well, we got a good topic, a couple of topics today I think we wanted to talk about. You know, I think the number one thing that we've noticed with some of our SIU work we're doing, and particularly we've actually been doing a few process improvement reviews, try to come in, help some of these SIUs tighten up some of their policies, look to what their technology is doing, see where we can help them with creating some efficiencies in the way that they operate. And the one thing that we've noticed is that oftentimes there are differing policies that are within different departments, and a lot of that creates, you know, some fair confusion. You know, the one that stands out to me is when a plan has a policy that says that a claim will be denied if the signature is missing or if the notes are illegible. And really, it's mostly on the signatures, because illegible notes, you know, you're going to get those denied because you can't even make an assessment of that. But, you know, the big thing is when you see an instance where the notes aren't signed, and the SIU has a coder, auditor, and the auditor does the review and denies the claims for no signature, and somebody in the leadership structure comes back and says, well, we don't deny for that. And, well, there's a policy that says this will be denied. And so, yeah, we don't really enforce that. And that, you know, that creates inherent problems, right? There's an intangible ROI issue with that, because you've got an auditor that could be working on an actual salient case, but is spending their time reviewing 50 or 100 records that are given to them for that. And that sort of lack of consistency across what are we going to deny for, what are we not going to deny for, you know, is going to create some inherent problems. And Wade, you know, you had some instances previously with some of the work that we were doing where that was really the case. There were some inconsistent policies, there were differing opinions, different people in leadership had different opinions on how to interpret things. You know, one person would say one thing, another person would say another. It was almost like, you know, two different sheets of music while you're at the same concert. It's like, just a different thing. And that from an investigative perspective, it certainly creates confusion, because it's like, well, what am I doing or what am I not doing? And then from a leadership, because, you know, you were an ASAC for a long time, and the consistency has to be there. It's an important metric, and it can create, outside of confusion, you wind up spinning your wheels and ultimately wasting your time, because you've gone and requested those records, you've done the analysis through the auditor, you've had meeting conversations, provider abrasion, all these things for something that at the end of the day, you're saying, well, we're not denying because of some sort of a technical violation.
Yeah, and another area I saw where there was such inconsistency was getting everybody on the same page as far as, like, how big of a sample are we getting? I saw some cases where we're looking at 300 different claims that took, you know, weeks to review, and these go back into the case that I talked about before, where it's time consuming looking at the qualifications for certain services during the COVID PHE, where things changed up a lot. So the regulations had changed, but there was really no consistency on, okay, what are we doing? Are we going to make it a standard, you know, pick a number, 100 claims, 150 claims, 200 claims? It got to the point where it was just kind of on a whim, because there was really no direction on what the investigators should be looking at. So it was, again, there was some that were doing very small samples of 50 to 60, and some were 200 or 300. So, and the other issue is there were things in the training manuals, if you could find them, that had a number that kind of gave a ballpark or had some parameters that we were to follow, but different people, even on the management team, had different opinions on, well, that's what the manual says, but that's not what we've been doing, or they have their own reason why that doesn't make sense to do. But it's like, if you can find the program manual or the, you know, the, for lack of a better word, their local PIM on what you're supposed to be doing, following those regulations. But then if you can find it and they're still not following them anyways, it just causes, as we were talking earlier, just spinning your wheels and not getting anything done. You could be working on something that's gonna result in some kind of a recovery or something, but instead you're working on a case that you might spend a week or two on, and all of a sudden it's like, well, that was for nothing. Start over with a new case.
You know, and part of that is also that at the end of the day, when you don't have that consistency and standardization creates professionalism, right? And standardization also creates credibility. You know, I was up at a plan yesterday doing a one-day training on with their SIU, just a day of investigative training and things of that sort. And the one prevailing theme that we wanted to get across was that if you do things in a standard procedure, it lends to the credibility of the organization, but it also lends itself that when you do get to a point of litigation, you always have to think about litigation, right? And the fact that if you've got something consistent, you're subject to less cross-examination. And, you know, you've done it this way, and this is the way we do it, and this is the policy, and it's written down, and, you know, that level of consistency that you need to have so that it doesn't matter who's working the case, you know, whether it be statistical sampling or probe sampling. If you do things in a consistent manner, it just makes life a lot easier and you don't run into a lot of the stumbles. But, you know, you talked about like a handbook or a policy book. You know, those are living documents, right? I mean, those should be looked at on a regular basis, right? I mean, at OIG, we had somebody who was a full-time person who did nothing but update, review, and keep abreast of the latest and greatest in what needs to be done for the policy. So it can't be you can't put it on your shelf like a compliance program. You can't just put it on the shelf and hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think that if you, like you said, if it's a living document, if for whatever reason management has decided that we're not going to follow, you know, section 4 in the policy, we're just not going to do it that way. And there might be, excuse me, valid reasons why you're not going to. But if you update the policy to reflect that, then you don't put the investigator in a position where he or she is like on the stand and they're saying, why did you pick 300 claims to review? I thought it was a good number. Doesn't your policy say you should select 100 or whatever? If we're not following the policy, change the policy so that we're, you know, that we can follow it and it can be consistent. And that's the whole key, as you say, to having a living document. If it's outdated for some reason and it doesn't make sense to follow those rules that are in there, just change it. Change it so that you can follow it. And then you can say, that can be the investigator's response to most of the questions, is I'm following policy. It's like, I didn't create the policy, I'm just following it.
You know, and one of the things that we recommended to one of the plans that we work with was, you know, if you have a case where the auditor has gone through 5 or 10 records and the only thing that they're denying on is something like a technical violation, like a lack of signature, maybe the recommendation should be that the auditor communicate a little bit more freely with the investigator to say, hey, you gave me 100 records to review. I just want to let you know I've looked at 10, and of those 10 records I looked at, the only issue that I'm finding is a signature attestation issue, you know, or a signature issue, not the attestation. And so, you know, do you want me to proceed on this so that you don't waste that time or, you know, do that? And that, I think that gets down to this whole premise of this trickle down, right? The lack of communication inherently then creates a situation where if that information isn't trickling down to the people doing the work, you wind up just kind of spinning your wheels, right? Because you're not looking at the right things. You're looking at outdated things. Maybe there's not even a consistency in looking at policy, which, Matt, that gets kind of to the next point, which is, you know, it's, we're talking about this right policy at the right time. Do you have, so first of all, a repository where people can go and pull the policy to understand what's the policy in effect, because obviously policies change, right? CMS changes policy, plans that follow CMS guidance, LCDs, NCDs. And if you've got an instance where someone is looking at the wrong policy, or even the worst case scenario is where there's a shift in a policy during the relevant time period, and you've got to look at two different sets of rules. Investigators need to understand that and be able to track that that issue, which becomes a whole other set of problems, because if you've got differing policies that are all applicable, you've still got to know which is which. And then the question then becomes, which is the right one and which one is no longer in effect?
Yeah, I'm going to call it the three P's, and we'll get to that: priorities, processes, and policies, and the changes that can occur in those things that can just wreak havoc on an organization. But policies, I've seen so many examples of issues with an investigation or a medical review where they've used outdated or wrong policies, such as something as simple as they're looking at Medicaid claims, but they're using Medicare policy to look at them. Things like that. And then, you know, and that's just going back to Wade's thing, wasted time, wasted resources, and a case you have to start over again. The changes in policies occur all the time, both internally within an organization on how things should be done, when should they be done, what are the criteria they should be done with, and externally, a plan is changing their policies on coverage criteria, on reimbursement rates, whatever it may be. The key is communication. You know, how does an SIU or a program integrity unit find out about those changes in policy? You know, is there a routine way of getting to that new information and then communicating that internally to everybody that needs to know? You know, investigators might be investigating a case based on the wrong policy. They hand it to the coders, the medical review coders, and like, oh, this is all wrong. Send it back. You've got to all be on the same page. So there has to be communication from external to internal. And then within an SIU itself, everybody needs to be working off the same sheet of music. Some of the things we did at the UPIC is we had almost like grand rounds in a hospital where we had the data analysts, the medical reviewers, and the investigators meet weekly to discuss the cases in front of them, the data plan, the data projects that they were looking at, the policies that were in place during the times. The coders would, you know, help the data analysts understand what the policies were so they could help shape the projects. The investigators understood the policies so they knew what questions to ask on interviews. And then the coders knew the policies so they knew what to look for when they were looking at the medical records. Without that, you're going to waste a lot of resources on things where, you know, you're just looking at it the wrong way. You know, and processes are the same way. You know, Wade's examples were, you know, our process is not to look at these things, you know, even though nobody really knew it. We have a policy and procedure manual. It's written there, but we really don't follow that. That can't happen. You have to be able to communicate what are the true processes and policies in place that guide the actions of your SIU. And then priorities, those are, again, internal and external. Let's say, you know, your plan has their yearly priorities of what things to look for as an SIU. What are their areas of vulnerability that they've identified? Are those being communicated to the SIU, or are they, you know, their data projects are focused on something completely different? So that, you know, when they're working it up, the plan's right. Like, well, that's great. We don't care.
Right.
And again, all wasted efforts.
And you know, the point that you made, which I think is a good point, is you were talking about at the UPIC, and just generally speaking, it's this cross-functionalization, or whatever the term would be, of making sure when a new policy comes out, is the policy that's coming from med legal or whatever the department is, right, medical direction, is it being shared with the SIU? Is it being shared with payment integrity? Are people up to date on that? And you know, the one example that we were just talking about is this whole premise in the E&M world now, right? The 2021 guidelines, they changed the guidelines in 2021. The shift is not really time focused anymore. It's medical decision making and the documentation. And so if your plan is pulling data for impossible days, and your impossible day is predicated obviously about time versus number of people, are you really spinning your wheels? You know, I would say if you had a situation where a provider saw 20 or 30 people in a day and it creates an impossible day from a time perspective, with the 2021 guidelines in place, is it really an impossible day versus maybe 80. And I think, you know, part of that issue in the payment integrity space, but from a data analytics perspective, is looking at the what are the average number of patients that providers look at from a peer perspective, right? If the peer to peer analysis is showing that the average number of patients that a, you know, whatever the specialty is sees is 30, and your provider is seeing 28 or 35, and it's an impossible day, the issue may not be a time impossible. It could be an upcoding, it could be a number of things, but you really want to have a situation where you've got, not that you're cherry picking, but you want the cream of the crop. If your provider is averaging the same number of patients of other providers that are similarly situated, is it really an impossible day? And so that really gets to, you know, it's not just policy as in the medical policy, but it's what's the SIU's priority? And, you know, right, how is somebody sitting down and coming up with the decision to look at something like an impossible day or not? And I think you've got to, from the payment integrity perspective, the directors of a unit need to be able to meet with the statisticians, the data analysts, the medical people, and say, okay, you know, is an impossible day really an impossible day? And understand that, you know, that there's that level of communication that's going to go out to provide that consistency, which then gets to the next piece of this, which is, you know, we talk a lot about statistical sampling, probe sampling. We talk about Chapter 8 of the PIM, the Medicare PIM, Program Integrity Manual. There's a Medicaid PIM. It talks about sampling is 20 to 40 records. We always are recommending 30 because it's a consistent number. And if you do 30, if Wade does 30, if I do 30, and we're testifying in an ALJ hearing, there's never an argument. Why did you pick 30? It's in the middle. 20 to 40, it's in the PIM. It's documented. It's written. Do we extrapolate? Do we not extrapolate? And I think part of that is that while you've got to have policies in place that talk about probe sampling and statistical sampling, it's still in that same vein of getting everybody on the page for consistency. Whether you're going to choose to extrapolate or choose not to extrapolate, if you're going to do a probe or a statistical sample, there has to be some level of consistency. And that level of consistency has to start at the top and trickle its way down in the right way.
That's right. There's no more vulnerable area for an SIU's defending their determinations than statistical sampling and extrapolation. That is where the defense attorney is going to hone their focus. Did they follow accepted standards and methodologies? Are they written? Did they violate them in any way? And are they consistently applying them across not just my clients sample, but all of the providers, or are they selectively choosing when and how to do it? You have to have consistency in how you do it, and a consistent policy written as to that is your guiding post. And you without know, that, you're in trouble.
And what's interesting about that is, you know, when we were doing this training the other day at this one plan, two of the people, it's a very small SIU. It's six investigators and one nurse auditor, and the nurse auditor and one of the investigators were the only two people in the room that had ever had to testify in a case. And the interesting thing about it is that in both cases, some of the focus of their testimony was on process, and it was miserable for them because they don't normally testify and they'd only done it once. So obviously testifying is miserable if you're not, even if you're good at, if you do it regularly, it's still miserable, right? Because of the process itself. But, you know, the thing that was interesting was that because of a lack of consistency in the way that things were done, there was obviously the potential that it was going to expose some weaknesses in the way that program worked. You know, and the one thing I always say is lawyers that are doing appeals work and ALJ work in regional areas are typically the same lawyers dealing with the same payers, right? You know, I knew in New Jersey, you know, we always had the same lawyers dealing with us on the same cases. And the thing about that is those lawyers get to become very conversant in the way that the plan does its work, you know, investigational overpayments. And the problem is, you know, if the three of us all work at the same plan and there is no consistency and we're on three different cases, but the same lawyer is involved in all three cases, they're going to find the chinks in the armor, and that's going to create a huge you know, on the first person that testifies, maybe it's not so bad. By the time it's the third person, it's going to be pretty brutal, because by the third or fourth time, the lawyer has had the opportunity to get their, you know, their hands on you. They're going to know that process, and they're going to know the lack of consistency that's there. And that's going to create, you know, that creates a whole other world of problems. And it takes, again, it's all about standardization and credibility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking about, just in terms of examples, is PT, physical therapy. There was a decision made at the, I think it was the district court level, that changed how to look at physical therapy from a program integrity point of view. Now, I don't know how well this has been communicated to plans across, you know, across the spectrum, but it was huge in Medicare and Medicaid, which was that it used to be that there were caps on the numbers of physical therapy sessions that a person could have, because then after that, it was just seen as maintenance and not not recuperative.
Right. And there was a dollar amount, too.
Now it's all, it can be maintenance.
But there was also a dollar amount that was ascribed to that. I remember at one point, the CMS policy was like, there was a $700 or $800 cap.
Yeah.
And that once you've exceeded it.
There was a set number and a cap, and that all went away.
Right.
With this decision, because now it's allowed that physical therapy can be used just to maintain the current status of the patient. They don't have to get better.
You know, and the crazy part about that, I remember working a bunch of physical therapy cases when I was a working agent, and you know, you had these instances of billing for services not rendered, right? Patients not there, they didn't get the service, provider bills for the PT. Well, guess what? The provider burns down that $700 or $800. Now the patient actually needs PT and they can't get it.
Yeah.
And there was no impetus. Like, you know, we would go to CMS, we would say, okay, here's this case involving, you know, physical therapist group, blah, blah, blah. You know, they've pleaded guilty. It's all fraud. They exhausted the beneficiary's benefit for physical therapy. If the beneficiary actually needs PT this year, they're going to get the claims denied. And there was really no impetus to fix that. And I know we're kind of getting a little bit off the beaten path, but the point really is that it's not just about being kept abreast of policy and the trickle down that comes from not having that and the right policy at the right time, but it's also being kept abreast of salient court decisions and case law that comes out, right? Like right now, everybody is up in arms about the reversal of what's known as the Chevron case from 40 years ago, where, if you know, 40 years ago, the Supreme Court had ruled that courts should defer to agency interpretation of a rule or a law if it was ambiguous. And the recent Supreme Court decision is that was overturned, and it's that the courts should be the arbiter of interpreting what is considered an ambiguous policy. And it's important to know that, because are there going to be additional cases that come out where the courts are going to interpret what could be considered an ambiguous policy that could be different from what agencies' standards have been for years? And so SIUs and payment integrity teams need to be able to not only be abreast of the latest policies, the historical policies, but case law and the ever-changing case law that's out there. That's not necessarily an SIU investigator's job, but it's certainly the job of the payment integrity department and maybe the med legal department to be able to provide that information to an SIU investigator, say, hey, this policy is not going to be enforced because there's been case law that's overturned it or something along those lines. It's a challenge. How often did you have to go back to CMS and ask CMS to provide guidance on something where there was a question about, you know, is this an issue or not an issue?
No, it was constant. It was all, we had so many cases involving some complex issues. You know, we had multiple administrative contractors that we were covering. Some had LCDs in one area, not in others. You know, so we had to constantly go back to CMS to get, you know, the guidance on which way we should go on individual cases involving PT, involving rehab therapy, behavioral health things. It was a constant communication.
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge in that is when you've got an instance where you've got two different Medicare administrative contractors, and there isn't a consistency in the what's known as the LCD. You know, we worked on a project here about a year ago involving a pain management doctor who was doing facet joint injections, and the CMS policy was no more than five in a rolling 12-month period. And the problem is that there was no consistency in the policies across the country. So this guy was getting dinged for this by a particular region. But yet in other regions, the policy wasn't five. In other regions, it was open-ended. And then the craziest part about it is that at some point, the policy changed where they took out five. So it was like, you know, exactly a differing policies, right policy, right time. And, you know, it's like, well, what do you do?
And think about it from the provider. Let's say we've got a provider that has two offices, one in New York, one in New Jersey, two different administrative contractors, completely different sets of rules. But he's, you know, he's running one shop with just two offices. How does he do it? How does he keep that straight?
Right. And I actually had that happen. I actually had a case involving a podiatrist back in the early 2000s where he had two offices. He had one in Trenton and he had one in Morrisville, Pennsylvania. So they're right across the bridge from each other. Delaware River separates them. And exactly that. He was committing fraud, you know, it was services not rendered or whatever, but the issue had to do with what was known as external counterpulsation. And for those of you looking for cases, G0166 is your HCPCS code for that. And you will find great cases on that because it's traditionally for people with stage two or three, I forget which, unstable angina who are not surgical candidates. But this guy was using something called the circulator boot, which was billed out under that code. And he was billing it as a podiatrist. He was doing it as a physical therapy service. But the problem is that one MAC had a policy and one MAC didn't. And he had offices in two places. Now, for this one, it was a little bit more straightforward because the fraud wasn't, he was just not rendering what he was supposed to be rendering for it. But it's a real thing. When you've got differing policies or you've got one MAC that has one or one MAC that doesn't have one, who do you go to play referee on something like that? Right. I don't know the answer. I think it's one of the challenges when you're trying to figure these cases out. Now, on a plan perspective, that's less of a problem, right? Because the plan is the one that's, you know, that's coming up with the policies. But what if you have an instance where in your network agreement, the plan is saying that when you submit claims, you will follow CMS guidance. Yep. Now, our example comes squarely into that. You know, I think most, you know, any plan that has a Medicare Advantage line of business has to follow the CMS rules. And so most don't have a bunch of differing policies, but there's certainly that the premise that that could happen. So that trickle down and that differing policies, it really can create a huge amount of confusion for an investigator, and particularly for newer or younger investigators who are just trying to get the, you know, get their feet wet and figure it out, you know, spinning their wheels, trying to figure out, well, which policy am I following? And then you throw in the fact that from an investigative perspective, if you've got an investigative handbook that hasn't been updated on a regular basis, and there are potentially there are things in that handbook that aren't even relevant anymore, right? And I know, Wade, you know, I'll give you the last word on this. That was one of the issues that you ran into was practice versus policy.
Yeah, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You have to give the investigator the ability or the opportunity to say, why did I do that? I was following the policy, and if the policy is outdated or wrong, it has to be updated. I mean, it's pretty simple in that view, but it's like, you can't have an investigator either answering to an attorney or on the stand saying, you know, trying to decide why I went down this road as opposed to the other. The roadmap should be the policy. And if the policy is incorrect or outdated, it's just gotta be changed.
Right. Yeah, it's like a compliance program. It's got to be a living, breathing document that you've got to look at, you know, whether it's once a quarter or twice a year or whatever it is. Someone's got to look and say, is the way we're doing this still relevant today? It was relevant yesterday, but is it still relevant today? And if it's not relevant, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be updated and it's got to be changed. I think that's the, I think that's probably the one area where I think we've noticed that plans tend to, from a payment integrity perspective or the SIU perspective, that they tend to create a policy manual of how they're going to do a policies and procedures manual, but then don't revisit it as frequently as it should be revisited. I think maybe at OIG we were a little spoiled because we had somebody in headquarters, good, bad, or indifferent. He spent his day doing nothing but issuing policy guidance and updating policy. But at the same time, if you've got the most updated policy, it just makes things a little bit more straightforward on how you can operate. So for plans out there that have those sort of documents, if they're collecting dust, maybe it's time to take them off the shelf and give them a once over, right? So that we're not.
I think it's important too to have a system so that someone's not looking at last year's policy manual, and it's, you can't have the situation where, oh, that was updated, but I always go back to this folder on the SharePoint. That's where I get my references. Yeah. But now it's been updated somewhere else, and somebody's still looking at the older one because they're right. Not notified that this is where the new one. It, first of all, it has been updated, and here's where to find it. I mean, if right. the creatures of habit, we go back to the same folder for, you know, go bys and references. If we don't know it's been updated, it doesn't do any good.
Right, and the same thing with go bys. If you've got a go by for a letter or you've got something like that, those also need to be reviewed on a regular basis. Are you citing something within the provider manual? Are you citing something that's not relevant? Are your letters saying, you know, pursuant to chapter 4, section 3, but that manual has been updated. Maybe it's now chapter 5, section 2 or something, right? And if you're citing something wrong, you know, a lawyer is going to jump right on that. And you know, you've put yourself into a pickle for no reason and having to explain something that you probably wouldn't have had to explain if everything was updated on a ongoing and continual basis. So a lot of this just becomes the belt and suspenders, right? You just want to bulletproof the ability of an investigator when they're on the stand to not have to have too much vacillation from one thing to another. It's that level of consistency that I think helps when it comes time to testify at an ALJ hearing or district court or state court or whatever it is. So I think there'll be more to come on that. I mean, I think we're doing a lot of that work now with a lot of our plans, because I think we're seeing a lot of plans that have been really entrenched in the payment integrity space tends to fall by the wayside because there are other priorities within the office, but it is an important piece of the puzzle. So we'll keep up with it and see what happens. You know, we're doing updates ourselves here at Advise on these things all the time. So it's these are living, breathing documents. So as always, gents. Matt, you had something else?
One thing, yes.
Whoa, all right.
You need to show off that shirt.
Oh, yeah. I'm showing off the brand new OIG Roundtable shirt. The OIG Roundtable. Look at that. Yep. Tough to see it, but yeah. It's the Game of Thrones. It's a real thing. It's a real thing. Thanks for noticing that. It's always good seeing you guys.
Nice seeing you.
Keep on keeping on. So everybody, as always, thanks for joining us on this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. Again, come find us on our new refreshed webpage, adviz@advizehealth.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter. Get your OIG Roundtable, your LinkedIn Live invitations right in your inbox every Friday. And you can get us on the YouTube channel, on Spotify, and off of our website. So we'll see you on the next episode of the OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thank you.